a bill that is not universally endorsed by organized labor. But in this case, I'm siding on the position of family labor, because that's really what this is all about. Imagine yourself as a family that has purchased a resort on one of Minnesota's many, many great lakes. You've purchased the resort from a previous owner who, after years and years of exhaustion, decided to either retire or go into something else. And in your first summer of operating your resort and living at your resort, on the 4th of July, a toilet in cabin number 3, a sink in cabin number 7, and a shower in cabin number 12 all malfunction, and you have families walking up to the main area, the office area, complaining that that's not what they paid for when they decided to spend their week at your resort. Under current law, the resort owner who lives at the resort is required to contract with a licensed master plumber to have the work performed and the work corrected so that your guests can continue on with their weekend. In my case, a resort on Cutthroat Sioux, Eagle's Nest as an example, this is a tremendous hardship, not only during the 4th of July weekend, but throughout the summer months, to get that work completed and to get those facilities up and running again. So that's basically what I'm trying to do here in this bill, is to repeal that requirement. I have a very strong suspicion, although Mr. Carlson, who I'm working with on behalf of the resort community, he didn't necessarily say that I should say this to you, but I have the impression that resort owners are providing this work themselves. They are currently doing this work without the proper certification and licensure as it is. It's just a matter of staying alive in business. So I see I have a couple of presenters here, Mr. Carlson and his friend
Mark Novotny.
And we're here to help the committee make a wise decision.
Thank you, Representative Anselton. Actually, I see the resorters have outdone themselves this year. In fact, everybody, it's fun to watch the reactions of people who walk into the committee and they kind of look over here and they make a strange look and sort of wonder what's going on. We are under a bit of a time crunch this afternoon, at least in terms of my own person. My daughter's in the state basketball tournament playing a game at Target Center at 6 o'clock, so I will be out of here at 5. So, folks, normally we're pretty expeditious in any event, but Mr. Carlson, welcome back. At least you look like Mr. Carlson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Once again, resorters have brought sunshine to the Capitol, and we are here to bring our issues to this committee, and we appreciate all the time you've given us. I can't say it any better than Representative Anzell did. The current requirement invites noncompliance, and the problem for resorters are not just the ongoing day-to-day problems, but a number of resorters were able to get a restricted license, but the window to obtain that has now closed. So new resorters, many of whom are here today, can no longer obtain the license that some of them were able to get in 2007 and 2008. This is just an impossible compliance nightmare for us, and we would appreciate the committee's consideration for repealing this unsession repealing of this requirement that makes it more difficult for resorters to be in business. We know they're doing this work. That is their business. They're in the business of serving their guests, and they just can't have the situation where they need to call a plumber from town to come out to Angle Inlet to do a repair in the middle of the night. That's the business that they're in. They've always been in it, and we'd appreciate your support for repealing this requirement. And once you vote, then I can take these glasses off.
Thank you, Mr. Carr.
Good job.
With me, Mr. Chairman, is one of our legislative leaders and president, former president of the group, Mark Novotny, who's been doing his own plumbing at his resort, Hideaway Bay, for a long, long time. He is the model for the shirt I'm wearing. And you have any questions, we're happy to answer it, but I know your time is short, and we're happy to answer any questions.
And thank you, Mr. Carlson. Thank you, Mr. Novotny, for coming down and for modeling the fine T-shirt. Are there questions that members have? Yes, Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of a question. You talked a little bit about the transfer of ownership. This wouldn't affect the installation of sewer systems or anything like that when it comes to some of those things, and that would be all the
Mr.
same.
Chairman and Representative, it would not. And as if you look on the bill on 3.15, which I can barely read, you will see that these are only facilities that are licensed by the Department of Health. All the plumbing plans and inspections have to be done by the Department of Health. This does not alleviate that requirement.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you all very much to the resorters. Thank you for what you do. We appreciate all that you do for your own businesses, but also for Minnesota's economy and boosting tourism across the state. Representative Anselt's final word on the bill?
It's all been said, and I want to thank my constituents and probably many of your constituents. There's resorts in virtually everybody's district throughout the state except for Representative Dean. I don't think you have a resort.
But he goes
but that's
to
okay. But that's okay.
And Representative Anselt, hopefully they'll be able to open a window perhaps that would be a good compromise in the next committee.
Very good.
Opening that window that might give some folks an opportunity. With that, Representative Anselt renews his motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails.
Thank you very
Thank you,
much.
Representative Anselt. Next up, Representative Fritz will move House File 2419 be referred to the Committee on State Government, Finance, and Veterans Affairs. Representative Fritz, it's my understanding you have a D1 amendment that is an author's amendment. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
And Representative Fritz said we'll move her author's amendment, the DE1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Fritz, send to your author's amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Based on the feedback from our last hearing as well as directly from members of this committee, I am proposing the DE1 amendment to House File 2419 that will study a series of questions only, including the state of retirement security in Minnesota, the potential for a state-administered plan to meet the retirement savings needs of workers without access to workplace retirement savings plans, both alone and in comparison to private and public alternatives, and finally, the different options for structuring such a potential state-administered plan and the effects of those options. And so the DE1 amendment before us asks MMB to look into the report, to look into and report back to the legislature on three areas of study. First, in questions 1 through 5, we look into the state of retirement security in our state, including not only needed savings and the progress of Minnesotans to achieve those savings, but also barriers Minnesotans face in savings for retirement, including lack of access to workplace retirement savings options and the impact on our state's budget and economy of insufficient retirement savings. The second set of questions in number 6 through 9 address the potential for a state-administered plan to meet the retirement savings needs of workers who lack access to workplace retirement savings plans, including a definitive answer to the questions raised about the effects of ERISA on the consumer protections of such a plan, as well as comparison between a potential state-administered plan and other options available through both the private market and federal government like MyRA and alternative actions the state might take to achieve that same goal. We all seem to share of addressing the retirement security crisis in our state. The final set of questions the study will address in numbers 10 through 15 deal with the different options for structuring such a potential state-administered plan, including investment strategies and contribution mechanisms, and the effects of those options of suitability, risk participation, and savings rates, discouraging employers from dropping existing plans and projected costs and fees, including in comparison to privately available options. In conclusion, let me say that in drafting this amendment, I worked to include all of those questions raised by the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. So though we may not all agree about the need for a state-administered retirement savings plan, we can ensure that this study will be a robust look at this potential solution from all sides. As such, I hope to have addressed the majority of those concerns raised during and since our last hearing, and I would ask for your support for the DE amendment and for the moving the bill out of this committee today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fritz, speaking for myself and the committee, thank you for all the work that's gone into it. It's a very thorough amendment, a real, actual, genuine study, one that I think not just folks around here, but folks in the private sector would be interested in seeing the results of as well. Are there questions for Representative Fritz, Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Fritz, on page 3 of the bill, section 2, there's a blank appropriation. I guess I have two questions. And Mr. Chair, I didn't hear what the motion was to where we're going to send this.
That's the point of it.
Okay.
It's going to the Finance Committee next.
Thank you. And then, Representative Fritz, do you have an idea what the appropriation is?
I do not.
Representative Fritz, Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, is that something that the appropriate Finance Committee is going to hear and decide, and then we're going to hear back and see what that was?
Yeah, we took that advice from Mr. Shepard. Mark Shepard drafted the, and that's why it's going where it's going.
Okay. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Fritz, I do appreciate your willingness to make this a legitimate study. I'm frankly a little surprised to see it back here after the testimony in the last committee. Is one of the options for the study that they can come back and say this is just completely unnecessary because of all the private options that we heard about in committee the other day?
Representative Fritz?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, yes.
Thank you,
Representative Hoppe. Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to the testifiers, is there any other studies like this going on nationwide?
Representative Fritz or Mr. Elliott? If you could just identify yourself once again, Mr. Elliott.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Elliott with Service Employees International Union. Mr. Chair, Representative, there are studies like this going on in California, in Oregon, and studies like this proposed in a handful of other states, including Maryland, and I'm afraid I can't remember the exhaustive list.
Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the reports, it'd be interesting to see kind of as that investigation goes forward. I think it's January 15th that this study is due to the legislature, but also to take a look at what they have come up with as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Swidzinski. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fritz, in your original bill, that you said that we would not need to comply by ERISA laws and whatnot. Can you tell me if the study will examine that issue as well?
Representative Fritz?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, it will examine that, and it is in number 6.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Are there other questions? Seeing none, Representative Fritz renews her motion that House File 2419 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance and Veterans Affairs as amended. All in favor, say aye. Yeah, I'm sorry. Representative
Fowler. We had a roll call last week.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we'll have a roll call. Call the roll, please.
Atkins?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Hoppe?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Anzell? Davids? Dean?
Aye.
Falk? Halverson?
Aye.
Hillstrom? Portman?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Lilly?
Aye.
Loon?
No.
Sanders? Schoen?
Aye.
Slocum?
Aye.
Sundin?
Aye.
Swidzinski?
Nope.
Tice?
No.
Woodard? And Zellers.
Motion prevails 10 to 5. Thank you, Representative Fritz. Thank you, Mr. Elliott. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up is House File 3073, which is one of my bills, so I'm going to switch with Representative Fritz.
Okay, Representative Atkins, welcome to the committee. Would you like to move House File 3073?
I would, Madam Chair. I'll move House File 3073 be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy.
All in favor of that? Do you have any amendments?
There are a handful of amendments. Also, Madam Chair, if one of the pages would be kind enough to, I believe one of the amendments that we're going to discuss is Representative Falk's amendment. He's in another committee, so if they could just alert him that he's got an amendment up. The first are just a handful of authors' amendments. The first is the 814-0896 amendment.
Okay, to that amendment.
I would move that amendment to place the bill in the shape that the author wished to move it forward.
Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none?
If we could get just a real quick explanation of which one this is and what it's doing.
Okay. Representative Atkins?
This is, if you can find the 0896, it's an obligor is denied benefits from a specific provider or made a blanket denial of a type of benefits or issued a general denial of benefits. Interest is due on all those overdue benefits within the scope of the denial, regardless of whether the insured or provider continues to provide ongoing proof of the fact or amount of each additional loss incurred. Fancy language for saying you don't have to continue to notify the insurance company again and again. I have spoken with some of the insurers, and I actually believe that they're okay with this amendment. And again, Madam Chair, these are simply author's amendment to put the bill in the shape that I'd like to start with. I'm not trying to say we can't discuss them. I just want to put it in the shape that I'd like to get it started with.
Any other questions? Representative Anderson, did you? Okay. Any other? Seeing none, all in favor of the amendment? I say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Aye. The amendment is adopted. Representative Atkins.
Thank you. Next is an author's amendment. It's the 0897. A14-0897 amendment, and very briefly, and thank you, Representative Hoppe. I should give a little explanation when we're talking about it. This just says when you go to arbitration, the actual party to the arbitration should be present. I don't think it's a huge deal, but it's something that was raised as a concern.
Any discussion to that amendment, members? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Atkins.
And the final author's amendment, Madam Chair, is the 0894 amendment, and it just added the words an actual dependent who lives with the decedent at the time of the decedent's death. It's my understanding, and perhaps some testimony may further this discussion, but that this was supposed to be part of the original bill was not. It was simply an oversight. I thought it was going to be part of the original bill, and I'm the Galdarn chief author. Once we get into the testimony, we can have some further discussion of that. That's an author's amendment as well.
Any discussion? Any questions, members? Mm-hmm. Seeing none? All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Mm-hmm. Ayes have it. The amendment is adopted. Representative Atkins, to
Thank
your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other amendments are from other members. I just assume do a brief walkthrough of the bill and then take up those amendments, if it's all right.
That's perfectly fine.
Thank you.
Your bill.
And what I would suggest members do, I know that you've had a chance. There will be some folks that will come up and testify with respect to the bill that may call attention to certain items. But what I mainly wanted to indicate is to applaud Senators Jensen and Gazelka in the Senate, as well as House members like Representative Dean, who worked for several months getting folks together, trying to find some, if not peace in the valley, at least some topics on which insurers and consumers could reach some agreements. In my estimation, the bill is actually a little more pro-insurance company than pro-consumer per se, but others might suggest otherwise. There were a number of items that were aimed at eliminating as much fraud in Minnesota as we possibly can. Things like an administrative penalty for insurance fraud, regulation of trade practices, the immunity from liability for insurance when grants insurance support organizations immunity from civil liability or criminal liability for releasing relevant information in good faith. It does increase medical benefits or alter medical benefits a little bit so that there's a little bit more reins or fencing around those sorts of benefits. With respect to disability and income loss benefits, we have not, I don't believe that we've changed those from a $250 amount per week in something like two or three decades. This does not increase the amount, the overall amount from the $20,000 minimum. It just says you can get up to $500 a week. So basically, what, $12 or $13 an hour rather than the $250 a week that it was before. Also increases the funeral expense from $2,000 up to $5,000. Still not a fancy funeral, but certainly reflective of the times, a little bit more than a $2,000 benefit. There's a number of other items that are summarized in the research summary. But with that, Madam Chair, I'd just soon take a little bit of testimony from the folks that worked so hard on putting the bill together and then get to amendments.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. And we'll call on these testifiers. Howard Goldblatt, would you come down? And after Mr. Goldblatt will be Kevin Goodnow. Get on deck. Take a seat. Welcome to the committee. And please state your name and proceed with your testimony, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Howard Goldblatt. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud, and we're in support of House Files 3073. The Coalition Against Insurance Fraud is a broad-based national alliance of consumer groups, insurance companies, and government organizations, including state legislators, the state insurance commissioners, district attorneys, state's attorneys general, that have been brought together 21 years ago, dedicated to combating all forms of insurance fraud. We do it through public education, advocacy, and research. We were founded through meetings between the insurance industry, the American Insurance Association, State Farm, and a couple of other insurers, the Consumer Federation of America, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, because they got together and realized that insurance fraud, at the bottom line, harms consumers, and that what we are trying to do is reduce the effect of fraud on the cost of insurance that consumers are paying. We've been working this issue for over 20 years now. This is not the first time I'm before this body over the years testifying on this issue. Let me address three specific issues and then get to a fourth issue. We strongly support the concept of civil penalties to the Department of Commerce. We work with the Maryland insurers to create a similar language in Maryland, and according to what I've been told just last week by the Maryland Insurance Administration, they are receiving thousands of dollars from penalties that they are now able to provide that helps fund the anti-fraud effort in Maryland. We think it will work here. We recommended it to the task force. We also like the concept of the deauthorization of providers. Why should a medical provider who is licensed by the state earn a living from the insurance system use that state license to commit fraud? Now, we're not talking about revoking the license of the provider from practicing medicine or chiropractic care. We're talking about not receiving insurance benefit if they are committing fraud. We also support the provision dealing with expanding the immunity and exchange of information. There are two main reasons we believe this. One, those laws were written in the 1980s, if not earlier, before the explosion of information technology, the use of computers, advanced technology to research the issue, plus the growth of organized fraud rings who are attacking the system through multiple frauds, through multiple insurers. If they cannot talk to one another, they will not know that a small fraud against, say, State Farm is just a piece of the puzzle attacking the Minnesota consumers. And that's why that provision is important, to bring it into the 21st century. The final provision that I want to mention is the provision on the accident, or as we call it, the crash solicitation. We believe that it's a privacy issue. If I'm involved in a crash, it is one thing for me to be able to see that information on the report. It's one thing for my doctor, my attorney, my insurer, and anyone else involved in that crash. But why should it be so easy for anyone else involved, private citizen, to gain access to that information, information that could they could glean personal information about me? Why should my information be so accessible because I was in an automobile crash? And so those provisions help protect consumers of Minnesota by keeping information to only those people who are involved in a crash. We worked with the working group in the Senate in granting this. We were pleased to see that they were able to complete this work of theirs in time for this session to deal with this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, members, for this testifier? If not, thank you very much for your testimony. We'll go to the next testifier, Kevin Goodnow. Kevin? Mr. Holton?
Thank you.
Yes, welcome to the committee. Identify yourself and proceed.
I'm Court Holton for the Minnesota Chiropractic Association. I'm a lot better looking than Kevin Goodnow, so that's me. This is just for putting something on the record, so this will be about 30 seconds long. We've spoken with the author. We think that there could be significant improvements made to sections 2, 3, 6, and 11, but those discussions and any amendments are better handled in the Judiciary Committee, and I just heard the author's motion was to send it to Judiciary Committee, and that's where we'll do that business.
Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And Everett Wells, is what he? Chiropractor? In Bird Grove Heights, is he coming? Is that him? All right.
Yeah, that's him.
Have a seat. Welcome. Identify yourself for the.
I'm Everett Wells. I am a practicing chiropractor for 14 years. I participated in all but one of the meetings for the anti-fraud committee. I do have a few concerns that probably got addressed by the MCA, and they're going to be taken up in judiciary, but I just wanted to get them out.
Okay.
First is the batch billing issue. I'm not sure where the line is. But basically what it says is once the replication obligor has been identified, you have 60 days to file your bills, or the insurance companies aren't responsible for payment. Now, I don't mind that. I think it's a good idea, but here's the deal. I have to have a claim number in order to file to get paid. So what I would appreciate is a more clear definition, maybe a claim number attached to that. It also says that they need supporting documentation. I think that's very ambiguous. I don't know what supporting documentation is. In my mind, it's soap notes and an exam. And here's the issue. When I bill an insurance company, I do it electronically. So I file it through a clearinghouse, it bounces off the clearinghouse, and I actually get a receipt when it's received. So I actually know the exact date, time, down to the second when it's gotten there. But I have to fax my notes in. Now, there's no way for me to identify whether they got it or not. And the other thing that you have to take into consideration is we're switching over to EHR systems. Everybody's in a big rush to get it done. And trust me when I tell you this, it's about a four-month process. And I think people are going to get caught up in that, not get their notes in on time, and then suddenly they're going to be denied payment and they can't collect on it. So I think that probably needs to be struck. And because, and here's the reason why, in order for me to get paid, I have to provide notes anyway. It's already in the statute, so I think you're kind of muddying the waters when you do it the other way. As far as the Commerce Commissioner and civil penalties, look, I don't mind it. I think it's a pretty good idea, but here's the thing from a practitioner standpoint. The way it's written up, suddenly I have two masters. So not only am I have to have a master to my board, the chiropractic board, but suddenly I may have another master in the Commerce Commission. That kind of bothers me a little bit. I think it needs to be clarified a bit. And, you know, I don't want to have two masters. Well, actually, I'll have three. I got my wife. So, and the other one is actually part of what Representative Atkins has tried to do for a couple of years. It strikes out the alternative arbitration system. I think that the fraud committee is going to put together a subcommittee that's going to deal with things like rights to a health care appeal. I think it is the wrong time to strike that off the books and then try to go and remake it at a later time. It's not widely used. I will admit that. I have no trouble admitting that at all. But it's there. And I think with the subcommittee being created, that it can actually address the issue and give the consumers not only the right to have a traditional arbitration, or they can choose to have the other form of arbitration, which would be judged by practitioners such as myself and not necessarily attorneys. So,
well, thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions for this testifier, members? If not, we'll move on to the next testifier then, Tim Lynch. And Bob Johnson will be after you. Bob's here. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Mm-hmm. My name is Tim Lynch. I'm with the National Insurance Crime Bureau, based in Chicago, Illinois. With this chair out of the way, feels like someone's sitting next to me. The NICB is a national not-for-profit organization supported by nearly 1,000 property and casualty insurance companies, including many who write business right here in Minnesota. The NICB partners with insurers and law enforcement agencies to facilitate the identification, detection, and prosecution of organized criminal conspiracies dealing with insurance fraud and vehicle theft. I will echo much of what Howard Goldblatt said. The NICB strongly supports House Bill 3073 as introduced. The enactment of these anti-fraud remedies, along with the efforts of state and local prosecutors and law enforcement, will help make Minnesota an unwelcome environment for organized criminal conspiracies to set up shop. Most importantly, it will help protect Minnesota citizens from insurance crime. An analysis of NICB questionable claims received by our members indicates a significant increase in medical fraud schemes right here in Minnesota, namely billing for services not rendered, overzealous solicitation of patients, and exaggerated injury leading to grossly inflated billings. Additional problem areas include staged auto accidents and collusion between fraudulent medical providers, lawyers, and runners hired to funnel unsuspecting claimants. A few statistics. Medical fraud submissions to the NICB over the past 4 years have doubled. Importantly, NICB's data is showing a reverse migration theme. What does that mean? That means organized criminals are displacing here from states such as Florida and New York, who have enacted provisions such as the ones you're considering. Also, an NICB report on organized crime showed that Minnesota ranks in the top five nationally in this type of scheme. And these are organized rings with ties to Eastern Europe and overseas. Last October, a federal lawsuit was filed alleging a diagnostic imaging company and 46 chiropractors were engaged in an elaborate kickback scheme aimed at defrauding the state's no-fault system of nearly $2 million. The fraud-fighting tools in Minnesota do need an upgrade. And it's, I commend the working group chaired by Senator Metzen and chaired by Senator Jensen and Gazalka for taking a very thorough look at this problem. Much as Howard Goldblatt said, we support all these provisions in the bill. We do want to highlight, though, the issue of this accident report solicitation. You know, one investigator here described the fraud schemes as these things work as a set of dominoes. Once one domino falls, the rest follow. He says the overzealous solicitation of victims is the first domino. So that is a very important provision of this bill. We certainly hope that some language could be agreed to that meets all parties' needs. But from our standpoint, other states have taken a good, strong look at that, and Minnesota would be wise to follow, again, finding language that works for all parties. With that, we strongly support the bill, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, any questions for this testifier? If not, thank you very much. And the next testifier is Bob Johnson. Welcome.
Madam Chair and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'm going to shorten because I know the clock is ticking quickly here and say maybe just three things quickly. First, I know we don't have the time here for you all to hear. It's a little unfortunate, but there has been a lot of work done and a lot of meetings with a lot of interest groups and a lot of progress made. So we'll put it that way. You're not going to be able to hear the benefit of that right here, including meetings with our industry, with the plaintiff trial lawyers, Mr. Carlson's group. There's some disappointments because there's some things not in the bill that actually have been agreed upon by a lot of the interest groups. Mm-hmm. And I've had a lot of meetings with the Minnesota Chiropractors Association. So just to give the members a little feel that a great deal of progress has made, mm-hmm. and we'll continue working with the groups. There are some amendments on the Senate side that further put in the bill the agreement. So I think as we go forward and work with Chairman Atkins and the chief author of the bill, that we can continue to incorporate that progress. This is just an issue, committee members. We need to do something. We've got problems with insurance fraud. It's affecting everyone in this, around this table, and all your constituents, and it's costing them money. So this is not an insurance company issue. This is a consumer issue. Consumers are paying north of $1,000 a year in insurance premiums, costs related to insurance fraud. John Choi testified on the Senate side, the Anoka County Attorney Tony Palumbo. There's a lot of players, law enforcement, prosecutor, insurance, health care groups. So I'm encouraged by the bill. I urge that, you know, support it, keep as much of it intact as you can. There are amendments that take it out. Maybe I'll just stop at that, Madam Chair, and if those amendments, I can come back up and provide comments on those. So we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Urge you to pass the bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We have one more testifier, Joel Carlson. Joel, if you want to come down, and then we'll go to questions. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Carlson, go ahead.
Like the Geico Gecko would say, 15 minutes will save us a lot of time here. You got 15 minutes left, Mr. Chair. Joel Carlson, I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. And just to be clear, no one supports fraud or fraudulent activity and in any walk of life, and insurance fraud is certainly one of them. We make a distinction, though, between the actual problem of fraud and the allegations of fraud. And some of our concerns about what's in the bill are based on allegations of fraud or someone's what someone believes is improper conduct, which are actually legal. And we participated throughout the summer in the fraud work group as well, and we're trying to get them to focus on things that are legal that cost the system money and not just fraudulent activity, which very little evidence of fraud has been presented, a lot of allegations of fraud. Mm-hmm. Just a couple questions about the bill, Madam Chair. to be addressed later. I agree with Court Holton on Section 2 on the administrative penalty order needing to be cleaned up substantially. And also would like to address Section 11 in the bill, which we think is not an allegation of fraud, but prevents individuals and consumers from getting needed and necessary information about their rights, their care that they're entitled to under their insurance policy. Our position is, and I do need to disagree a little bit with our first witness, this is not your private data. If you read the language that's stricken, the information that's given out in an accident report must not include private data on an individual. The information that is sold in bulk on private data mm-hmm. is the information that goes to the insurance company for rating your insurance and others. And they want to keep that, and we've been to several hearings on that issue. They want to keep that access to bulk data, which is private. This is public information. The public has a right to know it. The department can sell the information, and we think that this is, I won't say a solution in search of a problem, but this denies everyone's access to records and information that they need. And it's just an inappropriate response to an allegation of fraud. If there's fraud, track them down, prosecute them, prevent that activity, but don't deny me a right to get access to what is not private data, but public data. So we have significant concerns about Section 11 and how that is drafted. Thank you, Madam Chair. Happy to answer questions from the committee.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. And that's our last testifier, Representative Atkins. Can we go to these amendments that remain? Or do you want?
Certainly.
Okay. Should we? Representative Falk, you have amendment A14-0889.
I do, Madam Chair, and I'd like to move its inclusion in this bill.
Representative Falk, to your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I believe Representative Atkins can speak to this as well, but this would prohibit any type of exclusion to a family member in a policy, kind of an umbrella policy, that if a person is injured or unfortunately killed in an accident, then and it's a member of the insured's family, that they wouldn't be excluded simply because they're a family member. And we don't allow this type of practice in underinsured and uninsured policies, and I don't think that it should be allowed in umbrella-type policies as well. So the amendment basically, and if I'm buying the policy, my spouse or children should be able to be covered under it. And the reason I bring this forward is at least there's one case that a family had thought that they had bought a significant policy, but there was denial because the family members were the ones actually killed, even though they thought that they were covered under the insurance policy.
Representative Atkins?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am looking at the amendment. I agree with the amendment. I'd support the amendment. When this happens, there's no bigger surprise to a family member. They're literally shocked that they think they've got coverage. They thought they bought coverage, and then they find out that just because they're a member of the family, they're excluded. It's outrageous when it happens, and I'd support it.
All right. Members, questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Falk, would this allow, say, for example, a brother-in-law or the sister that lives the county over to qualify then too? I mean, is this just limited to immediate family members, the mom and dad, son and daughter, or if you happen to have your in-laws living with you for a month while their house gets refurbished or whatever, would they qualify? Who, you know, where does it, what is the kind of the cutoff, or where does that, how does that work?
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson, if you read the amendment, I can read it for you explicitly, 1.7, it starts saying the injured person is a resident or member of the insured's household or is related to the insured by blood or marriage. So that would be the extent of who is covered.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Falk, so yes, so if the in-laws are living there for just a month because they reside in the home for that month, they then would be qualify for under that insurance policy. Is that correct?
Representative Atkins, do you want to take
if it's all right,
that?
Representative Fultz.
Absolutely.
I think I know where Representative Anderson is going. I'd have the same question. I don't know that we're going to necessarily answer it perfectly today. But if you'd give us the opportunity to maybe, what I'd like to do actually is get the two sides together to talk about it and see what they would like to work out, if that's all right. But I get exactly what the point is that you're making.
And Representative Anderson. Madam Chair and Chair Atkins, too, my follow-up to that, and I have several, you know, that are related to that piece alone, is how would the insurance company then verify that those individuals actually live in the home and so forth? But it sounds like you're working on it. So.
Well,
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, exactly. It would be nice to have the two sides talk about it, figure it out, rather than come up individually and say, okay, it's... But I'm on it. I think it's a very reasonable concern.
Any other questions, members? If not, the all in favor of the amendment, say by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
The amendment has been adopted. To the next amendment, Representative Dean, the A14-0925 amendment. Yes, there you are.
I'm over here, Madam Chair. Thank you. Representative Atkins, since I submitted this amendment, there have been some ongoing conversations, so I would like to withdraw it at this time.
Thank you. That amendment is withdrawn. The next amendment is A14-0892, Representative Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is my amendment. It would delete Section 11 with regard to the prohibition on releasing public information. Representative Holberg has a bill that's proceeding through the process with regard to DPS releasing bulk data. And in that bill, the insurance industry is wanting to continue to get bulk private data. In this case, they're opposing the release of public information, and I think it's a little incongruous. I think this bill would have to spend a lot of quality time in civil law and data practices and judiciary, and I think it's just better if we delete this section. Oh, also the bill is going to transportation policy and transportation finance. So.
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Harper, you convinced me. I understand what the concern is that was brought together by the working group. I would support the amendment. I'd like to, what I would represent to the committee, I'd kind of like to work with Representative Holberg and see if she would have some thoughts. So I'll reach out to her. I'm comfortable with the amendment today, but if there's a way to address this and deal with it in a thoughtful way, and we unfortunately don't have Representative Holberg on this committee, but I believe it's alive and well. This provision is in the Senate version, so I don't think the discussion is going to end. I look forward to visiting with Representative Holberg about it.
Members, are there any questions on this amendment? We're in the middle of a vote. We do have another issue here. We have a testifier that would like to comment on this amendment.
Yeah.
All right.
It's really quick. Regarding Everett Wells, chiropractor, I'm back again. Ma'am, when we brought this up, one of the things that's not being tossed out there isn't whether or not it's public or private. It's whether or not somebody goes down to the police station, purchases the reports for that weekend, and usually it's a minority member that goes and does it, and what they do is they look at the last names, and then they figure out an address, and they go knock on the door. Okay, that's specifically what we're targeting. That's the fraud that's being targeted. It isn't whether or not there's mass mailers, which on a personal level, I think is an invasion of privacy. But what it's trying to get at is cutting off the people from getting the police reports, looking at the address and knocking on the door, having a response, giving somebody money to go to an attorney or a chiropractor or whatever. That's what the heart of this is going to do. So the only reason I wanted to put it out there is because if it does get voted on, that's really the intention.
Well, thank you for coming back to the table.
Yeah.
Are there any further questions, members, on this amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting this amendment, do so by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment has been adopted, and I believe that is all of the amendments, Representative Atkins. Any questions to the bill, members? Anybody in the audience want to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Atkins then renews his motion for House File 3073 as amended to be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The bill is on its way, Representative Atkins. Good.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
The next up is House File 2829, Representative Atkins, to your bill.
Madam Chair and members, I'll move House File 2829 be referred to the General Register. There is an A1 amendment that's an author's amendment. I'd move that amendment.
Does everyone have the A1 amendment? No, we're going to pass it out.
Madam Chair, could we have Mr. Lund explain the amendment while we're having it pass out?
Thank you, Representative Hopke. Yes, Mr. Lund, could you identify yourself for the tape? And
Madam Chair, if I might, before Mr. Lund explains the amendment, I appreciate that it's being passed out. I visited with Representative Hoppe earlier to show the sort of bipartisan, nonpartisan support we have for this bill. I'm actually going to head off to the state girls basketball tournament. Representative Hoppe is my second author and is going to sub in, just like a good basketball team would do.
Go Simley.
Go Simley is right.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that, Mr. Lund. Thank you. And I appreciate members' support for this bill when the vote comes up.
Go right ahead, Representative Atkins. Thank you. Good luck. Representative Hoppe. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am the second author on this bill, and I believe there is an amendment, and we have Mr. Lund here. I think the amendment is also supported, or at least the Mr. Barrett with Gambling Control is okay with it. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Lund.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Lund, proceed.
Madam Chair, Al Lund, Executive Director of Allied Charities of Minnesota. The amendment before you has three parts. The three parts were all brought to us by the Gambling Control Board with issues in language that they asked us to address, and we did that, and we are totally in support of those. We are in support of the amendment.
Any questions, members, to this amendment? And seeing none, all in favor of the A1 amendment, do so by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted to the bill.
Madam Chair, do you want to have Mr. Lund run through the bill a little bit, just hit some of the highlights for members?
Very good. Yes, that would be great. Thank you, Mr.
Madam
Lund.
Madam Chair, thank you. This bill is the result of work with manufacturers, distributors, charities, and the Gambling Control Bill for issues that, for lack of a better term, a technical bill for us this session that addresses issues that we felt that if addressed would help us in our management of our business. The oversight, we worked with the Gambling Control Board on all of these, and there are no fiscal issues on these bills. It is really a cleanup bill for us, in other words, an unsession bill, deals with bingo prizes, with people registering to play our games, bingo patterns, the deposits, the removing of the audit requirement, progressive prizes, and also the use of debit cards, which we'll probably have some questions.
Are there any questions from you members for this testifier on this? Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is really to the amendment that we've already passed, but the e-pull tab machine with 600 more or more in credits, if any of the machines paid out $600 or more, would that put the system in the red?
Mr. Lund?
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative, depends on where the game is at that time in place. So it could, but not necessarily so. And what this one really does is address the prize issue and the concern of the Gambling Control Board of people that would try and to compromise the machines. And typically people won't do that for a very low dollar amount.
Okay.
But it was felt that an amount of like $600 that we would then have your information. So if in fact you were trying to compromise the machine, we would know who to go to.
Okay.
Representative Woodard?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lund, I just had a question on the debit card piece. What happens if an individual uses their debit card to gamble and then they've racked up too many charges and they don't have the money in the account? then is the state liable for those overdraft charges that they will incur from their bank account? Or how does that work if they experience an overdraft charge because they've used their debit card and didn't have the funds at the end of the day? Because typically what happens when you use your debit card, you maybe rack up 10 different, you know, charges in a day, and that doesn't clear out until the end of the day. So what happens if the overdraft charges come then? What do we do?
Mr. Lund.
Madam Chair, Representative. So it would be my understanding that it would be the same as any other transaction that a person has. It would be no different. I don't believe that the state's responsible for that, but I actually don't know that. What brought about this provision, it twofold, the transition to a cashless society, we're looking forward to that, that at some point people are typically not carrying as much cash as they used to. But the second one was our major competitor decided to make that provision available to themselves, the state lottery, and they can do that now, and we wanted basically to have those same rights.
And Representative Anderson.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Lund, do we put a cap on then how many times, if an individual is kind of a frequent person that is gambling and experiencing overdraft charges, do we put a cap on how many times they can have an overdraft charge and then say they can no longer have any more overdraft and they can't gamble anymore using their debit card? Do we kind of block them out of that system, or how does that work?
Mr. Lund.
Madam Chair, Representative, since we have not used that before, we have not broached that subject about whether people can actually opt out or put themselves where they would draw that line. We do not have that answer.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Swedinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of my question goes, you know, towards subsection 22, which would be the debit cards. So I'm just kind of laying out mentally kind of a situation where if their youth person is maybe using the electronic machine, and are they going to be able to run their debit card right through the machine? And then if they are, then will they be able to deposit, because that information is essentially in that machine, if they have got winnings, can they deposit those directly into their account? Or will they have to then cash that out so they have cash? How will that, what are you viewing that situation to be like?
Mr. Lund.
Madam Chair, Representative, our system would not work like that. You would need to come up and hit a terminal that our sellers would access. It would not be on the device itself, so it would be treated as a separate. And then, so the money would then go onto the machine, and then when you were finished or when you were out of money, then that would be done. And if you wanted to do more, you would have to come up and redo it.
Representative Swedinski, is it? Any other questions, members, for this witness? Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Westward. I'd like to renew the motion that House File 2829 as amended be recommended to pass and go to the general register.
All in favor? It'll be re-referred. House File 2829 will be re-referred to the general register.
All right, forgot new language.
That's okay. As amended. And all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The bill is on its way. Representative Hoppe, I see you have another bill. As long as you're there, do you want to go ahead?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is House File 2199.
Mm-hmm.
This is the farm winery bill that we heard and laid over whatever day we heard this last week. What we're doing here, and I can have Mr. McCormick explain it.
Let's move your bill, Representative Hoppe. We move House File 2199 will be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Yes, and thank you, Madam Chair. And what we're doing, and I'll have Mr. McCormick explain it, essentially we're taking out the parts of the bill that have to go to taxes and leaving the remainder here with us, where it will still be on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill. And Madam Chair, while I'm talking about this, I'd like to say thank you to Mr. Kwapik and Mr. Reynolds and Mr. McCormick, who have exchanged thousands of emails on this particular provision over the last week or so. So thank you to all of them. And then Mr. McCormick, if you'd be so kind as to kind of walk us through the changes.
Mr. McCormick.
Madam Chair, members, what needs to be done is that the committee needs to delete sections 2 through 6 of the bill, which are being held in this committee for possible inclusion in tomorrow's omnibus liquor bill, leaving only section 1 to go on to the tax committee, and because that is a tax committee provision.
So we need to do an oral amendment?
We're going to take it out now.
So Representative Hoppe moves an oral amendment, then to. to the A2 amendment?
Madam Chair, members, you would be adopting the A2 amendment, but the oral amendment would be to, on page 1, line 2, to add section 5. So it would be page 2, delete sections 2, 3, 4, and 5. Page 3, delete section 6. And that would conform the amendment to what we need to do for the tax committee.
Thank you, Mr. McCormick.
So Representative Hoppe, then, on page 2, delete sections 2, 3, 4, and 5. Any questions to that amendment? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. All right, that has been accepted. To your bill, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and it makes me nervous to have to go to the tax committee, but I guess that's where it's got to go.
Representative Hoppe, any questions, members? Anybody care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, then Representative Hoppe moves that House File 2199 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Good luck. All those in favor?
Aye.
Say aye. Opposed, nay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, now is this our last bill? Okay, Representative Hortman.
Yes, Madam Chair. There he is. That's good. He knows a lot more
about this bill. Welcome to the committee. To your Representative Hortman, would you like to move your bill?
I would move that House File 2542 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law, mm-hmm. where all bills will stop this year at some time or another, and some of them get to go there twice.
And I do see you do have an author's amendment.
I do, Madam Chair. That the A2?
Yes,
the A2. My understanding is the A2 is a result of discussions between the auto dealers and the Pollution Control Agency, and this reflects an agreement between those two entities. So I would move the A2 amendment.
Before we vote on the amendment, Ms. Backus has asked to testify. Ms. Backus?
Madam Chair, members, Amber Backus on behalf of the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. We are appreciative of the efforts of the agency and Representative Hortman in addressing some of our concerns through this amendment. We weren't aware of this initiative until the bill was introduced, so we would like some time to educate our members about the alternatives available in the marketplace, which most of them don't seem to be aware of. Many are using lead, they're recycling a property, but don't know about the alternatives. We appreciate also the delayed effective date to give us time. We're still not sure if that is going to work. We're not sure if there are impending contracts with parts suppliers that would be impacted by doing it mid-year and are working on that. But we'll continue to discuss this with the agency and appreciate that.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions to the A2 amendment, members? If not, all those in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. To the amendment, Representative Hortman.
Madam Chair, members, this is a bill about reducing mercury and lead in the environment. Slowly over time, the Minnesota legislature has taken action to reduce mercury and lead exposure in different ways over the years. It's become something that we've done over the last 7 years, so we generally don't spend a lot of time talking about why we're doing it anymore because we assume everybody understands that, but I think it's worth just noting that the reason for the bill and the reason for working on this issue is that mercury and lead are toxins, and they're particularly damaging to brain cells in young children, and they're in developing fetuses in pregnant women. So that is the reason that we work to control exposure to these chemicals. And with me to describe the bill a little bit, I have John Gilkison from the Pollution Control Agency.
Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and introduce. Or
thank you, Madam Chair. I'm John Gilkison. I'm the staff member of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And this is an agency proposal through the executive branch. And our last mercury legislation was enacted in 2001 and 2007. And our view was that it was time to make some additional changes to the law to reflect changes in practices and technology, mm-hmm. and manufacturing and use of these products in the U.S. and in Minnesota. The overall goal, as Representative Hortman mentioned, is to continue reductions in the use and release of lead and mercury in favor of non-toxic substances. And there are also management approaches under legislation since there are lead and mercury products in use that need to be properly managed. There are six sections in the bill. The first two sections broaden the mercury product management requirements and disposal prohibitions that we currently have from specific categories of products to all kinds of mercury-containing products. The purpose of this change is so that we can do better education, outreach, and enforcement related to all products containing intentionally added mercury, and whereas right now we're limited to the categories listed in law. Section 3 addresses mercury thermostats. We have an existing statute that was enacted in 1992. It was essentially a promise by the thermostat manufacturers to operate a manufacturer product stewardship program. And we're proposing the changes here for a couple of reasons. One is the promise is not being fulfilled in all areas. In particular, we are not receiving data on the program collection effectiveness and the numbers and the participants as we used to. So we're adding a section on annual reporting. And the other changes are proposed to bring the thermostat law, which is the original product stewardship legislation, into conformance with all the other product stewardship laws that we've enacted since then by adding an explicit responsibility requirement and providing antitrust protection for manufacturers to work together in an organization to collect those thermostats. Section 4 eliminates obsolete allowances for the purchase and use of mercury thermometers. These allowances were included when we passed our law in 2001. We were the first state to do that. Mercury thermometers are no longer required in any state or federal law or rule. They are no longer certified by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and there are non-mercury products available for nearly every application. The proposal does allow the agency to accept an exemption that's approved by another state that's part of an interstate organization overseeing mercury product phase-out. And we've already done that for switches and relays and existing law. Section 5 establishes a sales prohibition on mercury balancing, dampening, and shock-absorbing products. These are generally legacy or obsolete products, and they contain a large amount of mercury. However, there are still a few products being made, particularly for rotational balancing of drive shafts and equipment, and we have tried to negotiate with the manufacturers on that, and they will not communicate with us. No. There are also mercury-free alternatives for all those applications. The final section, Section 6, establishes a sale and installation prohibition for wheel weights and balancing equipment containing lead or mercury. This is an issue that EPA, the states, federal, local government, fleets, and manufacturers have looked at for over 10 years. We've been a leader in this area, and the legislation would be a fitting conclusion to the leadership we've already taken. Mm-hmm. We were the first state fleet to go lead-free. We piloted what is now the 3M wheel weight system. Our wheel and tire contract at the state level requires lead-free balancing, and our public school bus purchase contract also requires lead-free balancing. The proposal is intended to apply to any motor transport wheel that uses balancing. And as a point of information to address some of the concerns that have been raised, farm vehicles and off-road vehicles generally do not use any balancing at all, and so they would be minimally affected by the law. In addition, there are alternatives available.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. We do have another testifier, Mark Kohlhurst. If you'd like to come down. Hello, welcome to the committee. Go ahead and
thank you, Madam
state
Chair.
Your name and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Kohlhurst. I'm Senior Manager for Environment Safety and Health with the National Electrical Manufacturers Association. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. NEMA is the principal trade association representing the U.S. electrical products industry. I'm here today to speak on behalf of several members of our residential control products division, those particularly that manufactured at one time in the past and sold mercury switch thermostats for residential use, which is the focus of part of this bill. This includes Honeywell, which, as you know, maintains its global headquarters for its automation and control solutions division here in Golden Valley, along with a number of other very significant corporate sites within the state. Before I address the relevant parts of the bill, I'd like to give you a short history of what thermostat manufacturers have been doing to ensure that mercury thermostats are properly managed when they come out of operation. In 1998, three NEMA members, Honeywell, GE, and White Rogers Emerson, founded the Thermostat Recycling Corporation, the TRC. It's a nonprofit recycling corporation that provides a nationwide mechanism for the safe disposal of mercury switch thermostats. It now has 31 corporate members. It's recycled more than 1.5 million mercury switch thermostats nationwide, and in doing so has diverted about 7.5 tons of mercury from the solid waste stream. In brief, here's how a TRC works. It's reverse distribution through the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning, or HVAC, trade channel. Involving wholesalers, contractors, household hazardous waste facilities, and to a small extent, retail outlets. The program charges a one-time fee for collection bins, $25. Manufacturers assume all other operational expenses for the program. Contractors, and to a small extent, the do-it-yourself homeowners, bring the thermostats to these collection points where they go in these bins and they're ultimately shipped to the Honeywell facility in Golden Valley for proper disassembly and recycling. So it all takes place here in the state. The members that established the TRC have invested heavily to improve the administration of this program, to expand into different collection routes, and the TRC works closely with state regulatory authorities on education and outreach for the program. Basically, this program in many ways is a textbook example of extended producer responsibility, with manufacturers providing an easy, accessible, and almost cost-free system for keeping a mercury-containing product out of the waste stream. Now, we've been officially operating in Minnesota and collecting a high number of mercury thermostats, more than 10,000 per year, since 1998, but as Mr. Gilkison mentioned, there was activity in the state before that involving Honeywell and the Minnesota PCA. So this is a very mature program, particularly in comparison to other states, and the industry has had a good relationship with the agency through its duration. Now, what do we do to promote the program? The manufacturers are active in many channels, mostly on a national level, but certainly specific to Minnesota in some cases. Most of the activities are aimed at increasing awareness and incentivizing the wholesale outlets to be collection sites and for contractors to choose to recycle the thermostats after they deinstall them. So the program engages in outreach through trade magazines, newsletters, a lot of social media activity, and trade show appearances and presentations. In fact, we had a session and a presentation at a very large trade show sponsored by the North American Hazardous Materials Management Association here in St. Paul last fall. So in summary, Honeywell and the other manufacturers who originally supplied these products to the market began to address the problem early of how they will be disposed and to ensure that they were properly managed and disposed at end of life. The market, as I think we all know, has all long ago moved on to electronic environmental programmable thermostats, smart thermostats, and other modern electronic environmental control devices. But during the transition, the TRC has remained in place, and it works vigorously with its trade channel partners and regulatory authorities to address the legacy product separation. Now, let me address a couple of features of the bill, HF 2542. In general, NEMA supports legislation that would complement and strengthen the industry's thermostat collection program in a particular state. Some proposed bills we've encountered would not have had that effect, and we've been compelled to oppose them. HF 2542 presents a couple of issues of concern. First, Section 3 contains the addition of the modifiers financial and non-financial to the requirement that manufacturers provide incentives to purchasers and consumers of thermostats to ensure that they dispose the items appropriately. We're not sure that those modifiers are a useful modification to the existing law. The term is undefined, and my members are curious about PCA's intention with this addition, and we'd like to explore it with them, and that process has already begun. So basically, we'd like to know a little bit more about what the intention of adding those modifiers was when the word incentives is already in the law. So we look forward to a discussion of that. To be clear, our industry has consistently opposed legislation in other states that would require incentives in the form of mandatory cash payments, $5 checks written for each thermostat recycled. We have found these to be inefficient, administratively burdensome, unnecessarily costly, and really primarily a punitive measure on the manufacturers. It hasn't worked that well, but there are incentives that can be productive without these complications. And if they're timely, they're less bureaucratic, and they're targeted at the right members of the supply chain. So we are very willing to engage with the agency and the legislature in a meaningful discussion of this issue and see where it might lead. Note also, TRC standard operating procedure is to educate and incentivize the relevant parties throughout the channel to make use of this accessible program that manufacturers are providing for free. The second point I'd like to make about the bill is that the success of the TRC relies greatly on shared responsibility. Currently, the law in Minnesota does not require HVAC wholesalers to participate in a thermostat collection program. Every other state law contains this requirement, because it's critical. Without active and widespread participation by the wholesale community, the program simply won't be accessible to the contractors who handle the vast majority of these units as they come off the wall. We recommend the inclusion of a requirement that would require wholesalers to act as collection points or be prohibited from selling thermostats. I have a list of how this is done in other states. I've shared it with the PCA, and we're happy again to talk about how we can do that. Our third concern is that we believe the bill should contain a sunset provision. And this is pretty straightforward. Mercury thermostats have been banned from sale in Minnesota since 2007. There's very few manufacturers, none within NEMA, none that we're aware of that we deal with, that even make them anymore. Non-mercury programmable thermostats have been available for decades, and they're now the norm in the industry. Collections across the country are flattening, suggesting that we may actually start to be on the downward side of the curve, measuring mercury thermostats coming out of the waste stream. So we're open to discussions of what the time horizon should be, but eventually we're going to get to the point where it's not rational anymore to devote resources to seeking out mercury thermostats that aren't there anymore. So we're confident that we can really reach a constructive outcome on all these issues through further discussions. We'd like to work with the PCA on this. The process is already underway, and I would ask that you grant us some leeway to reach agreement on these measures. We think it will actually strengthen the bill. So I thank you very much for your attention, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you or the members might have.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony and information. And are there any questions from the members for this testifier? Seeing none, is anyone else who wants to testify on this bill in the audience, for or against? I don't see anybody. Representative Hortman, back to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just renew my motion and indicate that we'll continue to work with the industry to polish the bill as it moves forward.
Representative Hartman moves House File 2542 be re-referred as amended to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. The bill is on its way. And we do have one more piece of business, and that is we need the to approve the minutes of March 12th. Representative Sundin moves the minutes of approval for March 12th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. The minutes are approved, and we are adjourned.